All roads lead to Bitcoin. That's right. You know, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we are extremely confident over the long period of time. Yes, we will have volatility. Yes, we try to manage some of that. You know, we do try to manage some of that systemic risk. But over the long period of time, we are so excited about the opportunities out there and what we're seeing in this space. I mean, we're super bullish and we remain very, very excited about the future. So bring it on.
This week, we are taking a look at the big picture, gold, bonds, interest rates, currency debasement, and of course, Bitcoin with former hedge fund manager turned Bitcoin fund manager, James Lavish. Stick around. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by a returning guest, a managing partner of the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, James Lavish. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Scott. Happy to be here and excited to talk to you.
Thanks for coming back. So it was, I guess it's been about a year and a half since you were here last time, and we were talking then about kind of the corner the Fed had painted itself in. It was sort of a conversation about compounding federal debt and the debt spiral, the inevitable debt spiral, cost of servicing that debt. I guess not much has changed in a year, but there has been some really interesting, I'll call it movements with interest rates and bond markets. And what are you paying attention to most right now?
That's a great question. Well, everybody's trying to figure out what's going on in the market. It's a very difficult market to be investing and trading in. You know, you've got every single morning, and you hear the big portfolio managers say this, that every single morning you've got some sort of headline risk. And a lot of that headline risk has to do with what's going on with tariffs. And so it's hard to really have a conversation about what's happening with interest rates and the economy without the possible effects of what the tariff war that Trump has waged on so many countries that we're kind of in the middle of. And so what's happening here is the market is trying to price in the probability of awfulizing that the outcome of that kind of the tariffs that we could be levying on goods and services or goods that are coming into the country. And so the question is, and of course the reciprocal tariffs on the other side. And so you just saw this morning we had a PPI print, a producer price index print, which was far lower than people expected on the recent numbers. And the reason for that is economists are thinking, and I tend to agree with them, is that the producers are unable or unwilling yet or trying to not pass through those increased costs. And so, you know, they're getting lower margins on that themselves and possibly waiting to make orders in order to draw down other inventory they have to produce with and wait to see what happens. But again, every single day we walk in and we don't know what's going to hit the tape. Are we going to have another headline from Trump that is very strong on tariffs? Are we going to have a kind of a softer stance for them? Like this last weekend where we got headlines that China and US have formed a tentative agreement that brought tariffs down dramatically. We just don't know. And so you're seeing that play out in the markets kind of real time here. And we've had a large drawdown in the markets and a large recovery from those recent lows. And so Bitcoin was down 30%. The NASDAQ was down 20%, or S&P was down 20%. And so we've had these big drawdowns and they've all but recovered that lost ground on these headlines. So how do you trade that? Well, I think, Scott, you have to pull back and look at the big picture, which is, where's the economy going long-term? If the tariffs are not going to have a structural long-term effect on our economy, then where are we headed? And a lot of that data that's coming in is looking weaker and softer. Inflation data, job numbers, you know, these are the Fed is now looking at these, but how soft are they? And how willing is the Fed to get ahead of information rather than start lowering rates again or starting QE again, rather than wait for the confirmation that we're heading into a recession? Well, the problem is you've got the chairman of the Fed, Chair Powell, coming out and saying things like, well, we're very concerned with the impact of the tariffs. There's a tariff thing again. And so even though they're supposedly data dependent, which is what he's said for years, the Fed has said, you know, Powell has said that they rely on data. They understand that the data may be lagging a little bit, but they rely on data in order to make their decisions. And that will impact bond prices, that'll impact the borrowing costs, that'll impact liquidity. And so the markets are trying to gauge all of that. So what you're hearing me say, and everything I've said in the last few minutes, is basically a long way of saying is the markets are trying to manage and trade around this just period of great uncertainty. And that's what you're seeing. And Bitcoin is definitely caught up right in the middle of it.
Yeah. I mean, it has caught up. I wonder if you could maybe just paint a little bit of a picture of, so gold has had a great start to the year and left, you know, in some ways left Bitcoin enthusiasts feeling a little bit left behind. We know, or I would say there's a strong indication of a relationship between sort of Bitcoin trailing global liquidity. And you mentioned Powell and the possibility or the likelihood of more injection of more money, time to print. So your take on like, where is this going? I guess it's like we have, and this goes back to a conversation we had 2 weeks ago with Peruvian Bull, talking about the problem of what Trump's talking about with the tariffs have led to foreign central banks accumulating these U.S. treasuries that are denominating in dollars that are becoming less valuable. And so there's an evolving market. They're trying to manage the market for U.S. treasuries while they're trying to control inflows, trade inflows to the U.S. And that's a long and meandering question.
Well, I mean, if you look at, let's back up. We have a structural issue in this country, and many other developed sovereigns have this issue. And the issue is that we spend more than we make, meaning that we don't, our real GDP is not generating enough income for the country to borrow as much as it is. And so we're running on fiscal deficits. And so that just means that we need, as the US, we need confidence in the US dollar. And that means that we need confidence in the US Treasury. Why is that? Well, foreign countries buy treasuries because they want to have something that's going to give them a rate of return that they believe is close to or above the rate of inflation. Okay. And because they need dollars. So countries around the world need dollars, and they buy US treasuries in order to have those dollars, have access to them. So when they sell a treasury, they have dollars they can use. And so you've heard over the last number of years that a number of countries have woken up to the fact that, you know, the U.S. inflation isn't 2-4%. It's closer to the expansion of the money supply, which is over 7% since 1971, when we got off the gold standard. And so they're looking at U.S. dollars and saying, well, why would I want to hold treasuries when I'm literally losing money? The only reason they would do that is because the U.S. dollar is, over the long term, stronger than their own currency, which is the case in most countries, in many countries. So, you go around the world, people want to hold dollars rather than, you know, bolivars or, you know, pesos. It's because they understand inherently that the dollar is stronger. It's got more confidence in it. But we need countries to buy treasuries. That's just full stop. That is absolutely paramount. And so what the danger that we saw here when we got through the first couple of months of this administration and Trump started talking about the trade war, the danger is that you've got countries like China that may, or even Japan and other Eastern countries that may dump treasuries, you know, in defense of their own currencies, or because they believe that the dollar is going down, they need to make sure that they get the full worth of their treasuries out in dollars. And so, and you saw then something that happened where you saw the yield spike on various treasuries. If you got the yield curve, 10, 20, the 5, 10, 20, 30-year treasuries, the yield started spiking. And that wasn't necessarily because of those countries selling. It was because of the concern that they would be selling. And so traders got ahead of this. And then you've got the problem, and this is going to meander off into real-world investments. You've got the problem of there's a trade out there that I've talked about that's called the basis trade. It's basically hedge funds who are long treasuries and short futures, and that are similar in duration, similar enough that they're arbitraging the difference in yield between the two. And so what they do is they take the treasury, they buy treasuries and then go and loan those out in the repo market and get cash for them. And so it's like almost a zero basis trade for them. And they short the futures against it. And so they're just arbitraging that. But this enables them to leverage it 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 times. You know, I've heard of these trades being levered up 50 times. And so the danger there is that there's $1 trillion worth of this trade out there. Why does that matter? Well, let's go back to 1998. I was sitting in a hedge fund in Dallas. Actually, it was in Fort Worth. The firm was still in Fort Worth before we moved to Dallas. We're sitting there in the tower and we get this phone call. Like the markets are going crazy. They're just like, all these arbitrage trades are just melting down all over the place. And we knew somebody was blowing up. And we got word that there was a firm called Long Term Capital Management. You've heard me talk about this before, possibly. But for those listeners who haven't, I'll go through it really quickly. Long Term Capital Management was a hedge fund founded by Merton Scholes. And these guys they literally created the Black-Scholes options pricing model, which is still used on Wall Street to this day, and they won a Nobel Prize for it. Well, these geniuses went out and were doing a similar thing as this with like the basis trade. And then they were buying and shorting treasuries, and they were arbitraging just basis points, you know? But they would lever it up. So even if you were making, let's say they were making, you know, one basis point, if they levered it up 100 to 1, that's a full percent, right? So 10 basis points, 10%. So they were using so much leverage that when the Russian ruble was devalued and bond prices went crazy, these spreads blew out and people heard about it. Here's the thing, and this is what's crazy about it, Scott, is that this was such a big trade. They had $1 billion worth of capital that they had levered up to what we believe was over 100 billion. So let's just call it 100 to 1, $100 billion. And they were blowing up. Now, not all this was in treasuries. This was in converts. It was in risk arbitrage, merger arbitrage, and all kinds of trades. But they were levered up across the board. Well, it got so bad that they were going to take down Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs had to be rescued by the New York Fed in a late closed door meeting with other banks. And they had to rescue them in an emergency in order to make sure that the entire street didn't melt down, because they were going to take down Goldman and then all the counterparties that were attached or that were associated with that. So there would be something called contagion, where if one domino fell, it was going to affect many, and it could have taken down a number of big banks. So they engineered a rescue. Now flash forward to today. The difference is that was $100 billion and it was in one firm. We're talking about $1 trillion of exposure that's across a number of firms, another number of funds, but $1 trillion of exposure to this trade. Now, yeah, it's a long time ago, 1998 versus 2025. It's over a quarter century ago. $1 trillion isn't what it used to be. As we talk in trillions every day now, it's insanity. But so, and that's because of the expansion of the money supply, the dollar's worth less than it ever has been. But here's the thing. It is so problematic and so worrisome that there's something called the Brookings Institution, which is a think tank in DC. Well, the think tank has tacit ties to the Fed. And what I mean by that is you have former Fed officials that work there, and they do a lot of research projects for, whether commissioned by or not, for the Fed, where they kind of float policies. So one policy that they did float years ago was the Somme rule. So Claudia Somme worked at Brookings Institution, and she did a study about unemployment and how unemployment bottoms out in a cycle. And if it starts to rise at a certain rate and gets above a certain level, which is 0.5% above the previous low, doing averages and stuff to simplify it for people, well, then it means you're in a recession. Well, the Fed uses that rule now, the Somme rule. And that came out of the Brookings Institution. Okay, so now flash forward to today, where you've got a white paper that was put out by the Brookings Institution that came up with an idea about how to deal with this massive basis trade that's out there, the $1 trillion of basis trade that's out there that could take down the street if it blew up. Well, what's their idea? Their idea is, well, instead of the Fed coming in and doing QE and printing money and buying bonds in the open market to shore up the market, and say, you know, we'll be out there buying. So we'll keep, this is called yield curve control. We'll make sure that the yields don't get out of control and that there's enough demand out there. So we'll just print money, put it on the balance sheet of the Fed, have banks go out there and buy this, and it'll go on the Fed balance sheet. Well, instead of doing that, the Brookings Institution came up with a brilliant idea. Instead, what they'll do is they'll just take the entire trade off the hedge fund books. They'll go long and short. So the Fed will just become a hedge fund too. And that way they won't have exposure to the interest rate risk, and they'll be able to just hold the trade themselves, and it's all solved. Everybody go home, everything's good. And so there's no repercussions. There's no accountability for hedge funds being irresponsible or having 100-to-1 or 50-to-1 trade on. They'll get saved. The street will get saved. The Fed will become a hedge fund. All good, all well and good. Let's just go home. It's absolutely utter insanity, Scott. And that's one of the concerns that people started having when all this started going around. You heard rumblings on the street. Is like, oh God, is this basis trade going to blow up because of this freaking tariff situation? And there was a little bit of worry about that. Now, before we go and get all apocalyptic and alarmist on everybody, this is just something that I'm watching. I haven't seen anything to suggest that that's happening. I've watched the MOVE Index. You know, I watched the credit spreads. I'm watching these, the SOFR spreads, which is the overnight rate that hedge funds and other institutions use to borrow money and use the SOFR as a secured overnight financing rate, which means that you take a bond, a treasury, you lend it to somebody, they give you dollars for that overnight, and you pay this overnight rate. Well, that overnight rate hasn't spiked. You see that spike when there's a liquidity crisis. It hasn't happened yet. It has gone up a little bit. The average is going up. So I am watching that, and it is a concern. However, we're not there yet. So I don't want anybody to think that I'm calling that this is happening. It's not, but that's a concern. And it's such a deep concern. It's such a big concern that you had the Brookings Institution put out a white paper suggesting the Fed become a hedge fund to deal with it, which is just mental. So that's something else I'm looking at. I'm looking very closely at where the bond spreads are, where the SOFR spreads are, where the yields are, and how much demand there is in the treasury market. And that's just something that's important to me because that's the most important thing to ultimately the treasury and the Fed.
It's an immensely complicated matrix. I wonder if we could switch gears and talk about Bitcoin a little bit. So obviously, Bitcoin's a much more sensitive asset to market sentiment, among other things. Had a tough late Q1 and has rebounded nicely, looking strong. What I'm interested in your take in is, during that time, there has been a number of high-profile announcements about significant institutional buyers buying humongous amounts of Bitcoin. And I'm just wondering as to what people should think about how these announcements happen, that while the Bitcoin price does seem to go up, it doesn't seem to be necessarily tightly correlated to the size of the kinds of announcements. I was one just today that BlackRock had disclosed another significant accumulation. And so we're seeing Bitcoin be piled up in these huge corporate treasuries, and we're not seeing like a wild Bitcoin run up like we have in previous cycles so far. Any thoughts on what's going on?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've seen a slight decoupling of Bitcoin from other risk assets over the last number of weeks. And you've seen gold have a tremendous run here. It has not left Bitcoin behind, but it has it's had a tremendous run when you look at it versus Bitcoin this year. The reason for that is what we just talked about, all that uncertainty. It has investors fleeing risk assets to go to the flight of safety assets, which is like a gold. We're not seeing them pour into treasuries the way they would normally in flight to safety, but that does still happen for sure, especially on the short end of the curve. Now, where is Bitcoin and what do I see happening here? Well, remember, Bitcoin, it still has acted mostly as a risk asset for years, meaning, and I've called it the tip of the risk spear. So when you see things, when you see Bitcoin moving, you know that something's happening with risk assets. Why does that happen? It often happens on the weekend because when you're a hedge fund or an institution and you see uncertainty and you see turmoil and it starts happening on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then you see these huge drawdowns in Bitcoin on Sundays. Why does that happen? It happens because you've got these portfolio managers that are sitting there saying, well, I'm going to get margin calls on Monday if we have this drawdown that it appears we're going to have. And because I have a levered book, so I've got to sell something to get ready, to get ahead of that. And what can I sell on Sunday? What's trading? Well, Bitcoin's trading. It trades 24/7. So if you have that on your book, that's an obvious first step. Take 10% of it off. Take 20% of it off, or whatever you think you're going to need to start making margin calls the next morning. Because what happens is when you have these drawdowns, like we've seen some steep drawdowns here, some really large intraday moves. And so when you have that, Scott, everything moves in tandem. And it's called everything correlates to one. We haven't had an everything correlates to one really big moment yet this year. There is the concern that it will happen at some point if we have some sort of credit issue or, you know, some sort of credit event, meaning something happening with bonds somewhere. But what happens is when you get that, when you have that drawdown and you have that volatility, the volatility picks up in the market and the volatility impacts the amount of margin you have to have on your books. So even if the prices of the things that are on your books are not going down, you know, the volatility rising means that your prime broker is likely going to give you a larger haircut on your borrowing. What do I mean by that? If you are borrowing, say, if you're borrowing 94%, they're requiring you to put 6% of a position down in cash. Well, if volatility picks up, then they may require you to have 10%, 15%, 20%. And we saw this happen in 2020. And, you know, it was really the first time in my career that I saw this happen in real time, where you had blue chip assets like Apple, Microsoft, you know, that were a 5 or 6% haircut that jumped to 25-30% overnight, where they required you to have more capital, even though they weren't going down as much as that. They required you to have that much more capital in your position to cover that. And so that happens. And institutions and money managers and portfolio managers, they anticipate this now, that could happen again. And so they look for the assets they can sell. So that's why often on weekends you see Bitcoin draw down like that, because it's something you can sell. It's trading 24/7. So now let's back up though, big picture. I really do subscribe to the belief that Bitcoin does follow the expansion and contraction of liquidity, not just the money supply. We do see a lot of charts where Bitcoin follows, you know, M2, and that is a useful thing. And it follows it in a 3-month lag, typically, you know, 10 or 12 weeks, where if you take the chart of Bitcoin and you back it up against the money supply, you'll see where Bitcoin follows it. Money supply moves, Bitcoin catches up. And so there's some great charts that Michael Howell of Cross Border Capital does. And you can see how closely Bitcoin follows that expansion of or contraction of liquidity. Now, that's not just money supply. And why I like what Michael talks about is because, again, we are in a system, Scott, that is built on completely reliant on expansion of debt, expansion of leverage and borrowing. It must have it. Lynn Alden talks about nothing stops this train. And that's what we're talking about here. There's nothing that stops this train because we're built on that. We're built on that borrowing. And so you need expansion of debt and expansion of borrowing to have expansion of pricing and these all these things, right? So what is in that number? Well, you do have M2. You've got the central bank and money supply. You've got central bank liquidity measures that either they're expanding liquidity or contracting it. That's either by raising interest rates, contracting liquidity, lowering interest rates, expanding liquidity. QT, quantitative tightening, they're out there selling some of the assets on their books. That's quantitative tightening. And that means that they're contracting liquidity. They're taking liquidity out of the market, or vice versa, QE, where they're printing money. They're out there buying assets with capital that wasn't there prior to that. So that's injecting liquidity into the markets. That's expansion of liquidity. Things like that. Things like we just talked about with volatility impacting margins. And that's not just on stocks. That's on bonds too. So when you have volatility in the bond market, then you have a higher required margin for those bonds. And so that is a contraction of liquidity. That means that money is going to be taken out and put aside to be held there as collateral for whatever loan you're getting against that treasury, against that bond. And so when you have volatility, that impacts that. Higher volatility requires higher margin. So that's another thing that Michael does, and it's in his calculation. His calculation is proprietary. I don't know exactly how he does it, but it seems to be, I've been following him for a while. It seems to be a very good measure. And so those are, and then of course the shadow banking, which is like hedge funds, you know, and private funds providing loans and debt into the market. That's an expansion. And when they're not, that's a contraction. And so we're seeing that. Right. This is a long answer to the question about Bitcoin pricing and risk assets and gold in particular. They really do follow this money supply and the liquidity of the total liquidity of the world. They follow it pretty closely on a lag. So why does that matter today? What are we seeing today? Well, we're seeing a cycle here. Liquidity is kind of turned over the last couple of weeks and it's contracting, but it had a large expansion before this that all these assets are catching up to, and they still haven't caught up to quite yet. And so we're watching this liquidity and seeing where it goes from here. I do know that Michael's thesis, and it seems to have played out when you look at his work over the last number of years, it looks like liquidity expansion and contraction runs in 5 to 6 year cycles. So, and that would mean that on his measure here, he is projecting that liquidity is going to peak in the beginning of 2026, which means that you'll have a peak in all these assets somewhere in the middle of 2026, you know, 3 months later, where if you have liquidity peaking in first quarter, then all these assets will peak in the second quarter. On average, in total, it's hard to say in individual things, but That's kind of what I'm expecting, and that's what I'm projecting out. Of course, this is all things held equal, and without some sort of, again, like a credit event that causes a crash, a drawdown, and a V recovery because the Fed comes in and prints money, or all central banks, depending on how widespread it is. Those are all things that are on my mind, and if that does happen, in my opinion, that will be an opportunity at some point in order, you know, to take advantage of if we do have a drawdown between now and then. But I'm looking for all these signs and signals to see if we're going to have one and if and when we are in the middle of one, because sometimes it's really hard to get a handle on.
Hey everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business, and thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, and people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out. There's been a lot of, debate about whether Bitcoin follows four-year cycles that relate to the halving mechanism in the protocol, or if it has more to do with global liquidity and sort of the, yeah. And so I guess, would it be fair to say you follow more into the second group and that camp, or?
Yeah, it is fair. And, you know, I think it was really important in the beginning of the first couple of cycles that the halving was extraordinarily important. I think it's less important today just because there's not as much Bitcoin that's being mined every day anymore. That's number one. Number two, the cycles, they could be attached to a number of things, including the halving. It could be the halving. It could be the uncertainty around elections. It could be tied into liquidity cycles. And I kind of believe it's all of that. And you have to take all of it into consideration to watch these things. But the reality is we've only had a few cycles. You know, it's a very small data set to rely on for major, massive moves and investments. And so I like to take it all together and look at it holistically and kind of gauge it that way. That's my preference. I don't rely on just one indicator.
Love to get your take on, we've seen this year, I think, an acceleration in companies trying to emulate or compete with Strategy on a Bitcoin corporate treasury strategy fund intended, and different takes. Strategy themselves have released a few different products now. They have kind of a high yield sort of bond style product. I think they have two actually.
Perpetuals. Yeah. Yeah. We can talk about that. Yeah. So, I mean, look, everybody wants to be MicroStrategy. That's great. Love it. I love that you have companies out there who are buying Bitcoin on their balance sheet or their treasury, and they want to use that. They want to use leverage to buy more. That's great. You've seen Semler Scientific do it. You know, you've got Metaplanet that's doing it. There's some nuances here that we need to talk through, though, for people to understand. First of all, MicroStrategy is it's in a class of its own. Okay. Michael Saylor and Shirish, his treasurer, that stumble is not fair. They discovered a way to monetize volatility in their share price. What do I mean by that? I mean that Michael had this, and he'll tell you himself, that he had this kind of sleepy, struggling to grow SaaS business. It's fine. It's clipping along. It's doing great. But he, you know, it was challenging to grow that business. Very challenging. And so he was sitting there one day, and Eric Weiss had orange pilled him, and he finally bought some Bitcoin in the treasury of MicroStrategy, and the whole stock kind of perked up, and he bought more and more and more. And next thing you know, MicroStrategy, taking their treasury and turning it into Bitcoin, suddenly had MicroStrategy stock following Bitcoin and being correlated to it. So why is that important? It's important because Bitcoin's super volatile. It's a volatile asset that's rising. So it's rising with volatility. And that's a good thing. Why is that a good thing? Because when Michael first started issuing converts and debt, he had to secure it. He had to secure that debt with assets of the company or with Bitcoin. So, but he soon discovered that when he was issuing convertible bonds, right? He had two choices at the beginning. He could just issue more stock, and as he sold stock into the secondary market, he would take that capital, turn around and buy Bitcoin. And the share price would react by going up with the Bitcoin that he bought. But he soon discovered that the more correlated the stock was to Bitcoin, the more volatility there was, the more appetite there was for these convertible bonds. And the convertible bonds are bonds that can be converted into common equity. And hedge funds love these things. Why do they love them? Because you've got this bond that can be converted into the common stock. well, that means that you own this bond. You can short the common stock against it. And in a certain ratio, it's called a delta hedge, the optimal ratio to short against it. And as the stock price goes up and down, you can be shorting more as it goes up and then covering it as it comes down, and then shorting more as it comes up and covering it. But your hedge, you own this bond, and you're just short some of it through common equity, that delta optimal hedge. And you could trade around it and make money as that stock is really volatile. You can trade around it and make money on it. That's number one. The second thing is, because it's volatile, it's a rising asset that's volatile, then this conversion price on this bond may be, so if MicroStrategy today is trading at $337 or $397, sorry, then, some of these bonds are convertible way down below that, right? And so now these convertible bond owners are way in the money and have made way more money they would have on just an interest rate on this bond, because they were able to convert it and they have the optionality to the upside. It's like an option that doesn't expire for a very long time. And so until those bonds can be called. So the bond buyers, like, they suddenly said, no, don't give us an interest rate. We don't care about the interest rate. Give us a good conversion price. And then that conversion price will calculate out what that's worth because of the volatility of the stock and what we need on that. And then we'll buy your bond and we'll loan you money for free. So we'll give you the money for free. We'll buy the bond and then we'll delta hedge around it and play around it. And then hopefully we'll get into the money and we'll convert into common stock. We'll make a whole bunch of money on the back end. And the other side, Michael's taking that capital. He's turning around and buying Bitcoin with it. And it's accretive to his balance sheet, because now he's borrowed for free. He buys Bitcoin with it and his stock goes up $2 for every dollar that he bought Bitcoin with right now. That's the conversion rate right now, the multiple on underlying NAV, net asset value of the Bitcoin. If you take every single bond and every single share and you convert it in, and you assume that's a common unit, so you it's fully diluted, then you would say that his stock is now worth about 2.1 the underlying Bitcoin. So every single dollar that he buys from a convert sale, the stock goes up 2 to 1 right now. And so it's been great for shareholders. And so that is a very unique situation, because he's been able to tap into this massive, massive world of convertible bonds and create an accretive acquisition of Bitcoin to his balance sheet. You have other companies that are trying to do it. Semler Scientific is a much, much, much smaller case. They're trying to do the same thing, same playbook. Love it. Keep going. They do not have the same multiple because they're not able to tap the convert market like Michael can. You've got Metaplanet, which is a Japanese company that is doing it. And what they're doing is a little bit different, because they can't tap the convert. There's no convert market out there either, but they can issue shares and buy stock or buy Bitcoin through issuing shares. And they've been doing that. What's important about Metaplanet is they get a very high multiple of NAV out there, because there's no function for buying Bitcoin in the Japanese stock market. There are no ETFs or no Bitcoin ETFs out there. So if you have a retirement account or investment account that you have capital in, you don't want to go buy real Bitcoin on some strange exchange that you don't know, or depending on the jurisdiction, you just want to buy it in your retirement account or your investment account. Well, there's no way to do that. Well, now Metaplanet gives you a way to do that. They've kind of done an end zone run around regulators there and saying, well, we own Bitcoin on the balance sheet, but the investors want to buy our stock and the stock is worth a lot of Bitcoin. And so that's what they've been doing. So that's more of a geographical problem they've solved, challenge. And now you've got this new one, Cantor Equity Partners. Was just announced. CEP it's a SPAC, a Cantor Equity Partners SPAC. And so they teamed up with Tether and SoftBank to create a new company called 21 that's going to be headed up by Jack Mallers. Jack Mallers of Strike, he's going to be the CEO of both companies. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to do the same sort of thing where they're buying Bitcoin and they're buying companies and creating income in order to go buy more Bitcoin. But then their goal, ultimate goal, and they've said this explicitly, is to become a Bitcoin finance company where they're going to have lending products and collateralized products around that. And so that's their ultimate goal. So it's a little bit different than what Michael Saylor has said explicitly with his company. Although, you know, it would make sense for Michael's company strategy to become the JP Morgan of the Bitcoin world, you know, Bitcoin finance. He's light years ahead of everybody. So, but those are all the things that are kind of happening out there in not all of them. There are more. They're more every day. You know, we've got a situation with Matador. You've seen David Bailey. He's got a new one, Nakamoto, and there are things going on that are out there. They're very exciting, and we welcome them. And I think that it is healthy for companies to see how positive the reaction is from investors when you add Bitcoin to your balance sheet, to your treasury. I think it's a really positive thing for institutions to start getting their head around the fact that adding Bitcoin to your balance sheet, adding Bitcoin to your treasury is a positive thing.
Love to ask you one final question if I can, James. You mentioned lending products and potentially the future of strategy. And, you know, as we've seen them diversify into some of these different ideas, there's a lot of innovation. We're kind of in this place where it's like the innovation of the financialization of Bitcoin. And in the U.S. this year, there was an important piece of legislation that's going to enable retail banks to start custodying Bitcoin for customers. And this could be kind of paving the way for Bitcoin's application as something that people use as collateral and don't sell. And so just love to get your thoughts on what that might mean. You know, what does Bitcoin become when everyone understands that you might not need to sell it?
Well, this is really important. That was SAB 121. It was a staff accounting bulletin that the SEC issued. So instead of going through legislation a little over a year ago, they issued this accounting bulletin that said, if you're a bank that has any crypto dealings, then you have to offset any asset that you've got held on your books with a liability. And it was very onerous for banks, and they made these rules the reporting rules were just onerous. And it was really, Scott, part of choke point 2.0, you know, where Gary Gensler was strong-armed by Elizabeth Warren and her ridiculous anti-crypto army, which arguably really hurt the Democratic and Biden and ultimately the Harris campaign, because they were just obstinate about the demand for cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in this nation. And so it prevented banks from dealing with customers that had any cryptocurrency aspect to their business. I mean, we felt it at the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, where we were raising money in 2023, 2024, and we were hurt by this choke point 2.0, where banks just refused to do business with anyone who had cryptocurrency ties or Bitcoin ties. We had investors trying to wire us money, and the wires were canceled. They were returned. They were refused. We even had a couple of people that were debanked from their banks because they said, you're dealing with shady things, and you're no longer eligible to be a customer here. I mean, just insane stuff. So, and meanwhile, we're a Delaware registered investment fund, you know, we were completely above board. We've been doing this for 30 years in hedge funds and private equity. Everything is to the T, you know, we're methodical and following every single SEC, you know, and state and government rule. Didn't matter. Okay, so that was SAB 121 that they had issued that bulletin. And so banks and financial institutions took heed. They just avoided it altogether. They didn't want the headache. They didn't want to deal with the legislation through enforcement rather than through actual right channels of legislation, you know? So what they did was we had Congress finally woke up to it and said, this is ridiculous that you guys did an end zone run around us rather than having like real legislation. You issued this nonsense bulletin and we're going to repeal it. And they went through a vote in the House and Senate, and they repealed it. It went to Biden's desk, and Biden, being, you know, a mental cadaver at this point, did whatever Elizabeth Warren said, and he vetoed it. And so he vetoed the repeal and it went back into effect. And so everybody was upset, obviously. Like, this is not good for the growth of this you know, booming landscape that's happening across the world. The United States is getting left behind. Let's go. Wake up. Like, what are you doing? And so Trump comes into office and embraces cryptocurrency and Bitcoin immediately. Gary Gensler resigns from the SEC, the chair of the SEC. And what happens? Well, there's a new bulletin that's issued. It's SOB 122, and it repeals SOB 121, and it's all over. So now that means that banks can custody Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, certain cryptocurrencies, and they can now do it without having to have a liability on their balance sheet. So what does that mean for customers? Well, it means that they're going to wade into this space and start offering the ability to buy and sell Bitcoin and sell other cryptocurrencies, I expect, right there in your account. Hold it there in your accounts, and you'll be able to eventually, right away, but eventually they're going to create products around it where you can borrow against it, not have to sell it. You may be able to pledge a certain amount of your Bitcoin in order to get a mortgage for a house instead of having to sell it and pay the capital gains tax on it or whatever. You can borrow against it or put it into escrow without selling it, and have it as part of your mortgage down payment, you know, things like that. And so it's really important. And that, I think this is going to happen, because this is something that a lot of people aren't talking about. So I'm glad you brought it up. I think this is a very, very important development. And we're going to see more and more big banks. You just saw Schwab, they're pouring into this world. They're, you know, they're headed into this world full steam ahead. And they want to be part of this. They see how big of an opportunity it is financially for them and for their customers. And they want to be a part of it. And so I think you're going to see, you know, the likes of the Citigroups, Citibank and Wells Fargo and other large banks, and even the JP Morgans of the world with Chase, come in and offer products around this. I think it's going to be a big deal. It's going to take a number of months to see them start rolling these things out. But you better believe that they're assembling their staff around it, and they're doing their research, and they're starting to, you know, create products that they're going to roll out to market in the next year or two. It's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, and even MasterCard has been very public about their investment in, like, forthcoming Bitcoin and, I guess, crypto related products. So yeah, it definitely feels like some big tailwinds. Lots we've covered. Long-term, we know liquidity is only going one way over a long enough time frame, and all roads lead to Bitcoin.
All roads lead to Bitcoin. That's right. So, yeah, you know, I'm all I can say is that, you know, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we are extremely confident over the long period of time. Yes, we will have volatility. Yes, we try to manage some of that. And we do try to manage some of that systemic risk. But over the long period of time, we are so excited about the opportunities out there and what we're seeing in this space. I mean, we're super bullish, and we remain very, very excited about the future. So bring it on.
James, appreciate you coming back on the show. For listeners who want to find more of you, I know you're active on Twitter, Substack, anywhere that we should send people specifically.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So yeah, I write The Informationist. It's a newsletter that comes out once every week, every Sunday, and it simplifies financial concept, kind of like the stuff we talked about today. I take one concept and simplify it. It's done really well. I'm super excited. It's got over 40,000 subscribers now, and there's a free version, and it's something I love to do. I love to just, I love people, you know, making people smarter one piece at a time. So, and it's good for anybody. It's easy to read. It's simple. So that's one. And then of course, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, for those of you who, there you go, who don't know about it, you can go to bitcoinopportunity.fund and get more information on it. If you want to get information, we just launched Fund 2, and we've already raised about 20% of the capital that we had our goal set for in just the first month and a half here. And so we're excited about that. And if you are if you're an accredited investor, it's for accredited investors only, but come to the website and just reach out. We'll send you some information, or we can have a call or whatever. So, but yeah, we're really excited, Scott, and we're bullish for the future. We feel like we're in a great position.
Well, thanks again, James. And if you're listening to this show and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and Hope to see you next week.
Thank you for having me, Scott. Look forward to the next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.